You are listening to Boston Public Radio. I'm Edgar B. Herwick III. Well, it appears as I look out the window here in our studios that Mother Nature is a Patriots fan because she's delivered a dismal day that embodies how I think Pat's players, coaches, and certainly fans are feeling this afternoon following a very tough loss last night to a San Francisco 49ers team in a game that I think a lot of people were calling a potential Super Bowl preview. So here to walk us through what happened yesterday for those of you who bailed after the first half and went to sleep, and to look over a couple of other notable things happening in the Boston sports scene is Joe Sullivan, sports editor for the Boston Globe. Joe, welcome back to Boston Public Radio.
Thanks, Edgar.
So quite a game last night.
It really was. Almost an incredible comeback by the Patriots after a first half that was just about indescribable and how bad it was. They did many, many unpatriot-like things. Two interceptions, two fumble recoveries, and that's why they were so far behind, 31-3 in the second half. And then by rallying and tying a game at 31-31, if they had been able to win that game, it would have been tied for the greatest comeback in NFL history.
That's crazy.
Teams don't come back from 28 points down usually, but I just saw Chris Gasper, who's the columnist of the Globe, just tweeted something very interesting. The Patriots offense ran 62 plays in the second half. The 49ers ran 65 plays in the game.
Wow.
So it just shows how quick they were running their offense and how they're able to score so quickly. They're just so fast.
What was the difference between the two halves and that they played so poorly in that first half and were able to come back, make a 28-point deficit up basically in a period of almost like 15 minutes?
Yeah, I think the turnovers are what caused the problem in the first half and allowed the 49ers to control the ball and play at a slower pace. It's almost like we're talking about basketball here rather than football.
Right.
That's more of that type of conversation. But it is true. The 49ers are actually statistically the slowest running offense in the NFL, and the Patriots are the fastest.
Do the teams think of it this way? I mean, you know, is this like a part of a 49ers strategy? Is this something that when they're looking at a game, are they trying to say we want to run as few plays as possible because this gives us some kind of advantage? And are the Patriots saying we want to run as many plays as possible because it gives our style some kind of advantage?
Yeah, I've never heard it talked about in terms of running fewer plays necessarily.
Right.
You do hear about the underdog wanting to shorten the game, so fewer plays helps the underdog pull off an upset. But the 49ers couldn't be described as any kind of a big underdog. I mean, they're a terrific team. This is a possible Super Bowl preview. But it's definitely talked about how many plays you can run on offense from the Patriots' point of view, increasing the number you can run. This is really kind of a radical new philosophy in football that's spearheaded by University of Oregon, where Chip Kelly, who's someone who used to coach at the University of New Hampshire, is the coach. How many plays can we run? How quickly can we run them?
And the Patriots do this. One of the things that they've implemented is a lot of no huddle.
Yeah,
which
kind of
changes the whole look and feel of the game. You see Tom Brady come right up to the line and he's barking orders. And I've noticed the television coverage has now got the mics down there, and you hear him like yelling
whiskey,
things out.
Whiskey last night was a new one I hadn't heard before. They must change the calls. But I guess I'm trying to sell the Globe here on air. But if Greg Bedard of our staff had a terrific story earlier this season about the Patriots' no huddle offense, where they actually got a visit from the Oregon coach, Chip Kelly, over the summer. And what Oregon does and what the Patriots are trying to do when they're in no huddle is they use one word. That word carries all the assignments for the blocking and the pass routes for the players. It's really new wave stuff, like the implants in the brain type of thing.
Yeah.
So when Tom Brady yells out whiskey, I mean, it could mean nothing because, you know, there has
to be some deception.
It could
be like a little bit of a chess match kind of thing.
Yes, but it could also mean that Brandon Lloyd knows what pattern to run, that he's going to run down the left sideline, and Wes Welker knows he's supposed to go down and in. And that's the play they run so quickly.
What kind of pressure does that put on players? Is it different than how it's been? I think, you know, certainly you've heard increasingly about the importance of prep on these players. You hear the Wunderlich test come up all the time when you're looking at drafts, which is a test which is, in theory, is supposed to test your football IQ.
The Wunderlich?
Yeah.
No, that's not true, Edgar.
Oh, really?
The Wunderlich is given to by many corporations.
It's just a straight intelligence test.
It's not an intelligence test. It is. They wouldn't pretend it was. It's more of a test of how quickly you can think and accumulated knowledge.
So that correlates with the football IQ because you need speed like thinking in these kinds of a situation, or is it just in order to learn new plays every week kind of thing?
Yeah, I think that if you did well on the Wonderlic, that would help you with this type of offense. At the Globe, we got a copy of the Wonderlic and we were giving the test to people. I actually went myself and gave it to some emergency room doctors.
No kidding.
At Boston Medical Center, yeah. And this is going to shock you. They did great.
Really?
We also wanted to give it to air traffic controllers.
No kidding.
But the union wouldn't agree. They wouldn't let us do it.
No? Have you ever taken it yourself?
I did not, because I didn't want to be embarrassed. But we did, because we had it in the office, and we did have like a Wonderlic standoff, like people who thought they would do well. So we had like 5-6 people who thought they would do really well, took it in the office. And Don Squar, who was the former sports editor of Globe before me, a really smart person, did very well.
Oh, there you go. I'm talking with Joe Sullivan, the current sports editor at the Boston Globe. We were talking about the Patriots. Now we're talking about the Wonderlic test.
How'd
learning something new here on Boston Public Radio. Just getting back to the game, like you said, a couple of non-Patriot things happened. There were some turnovers. There were some... lack of converting on third down, which is something they've been good at through the whole year. I guess they were 2 of 15 on the whole game. They didn't convert on a third down in the entire first half. Is there anything that happened in this game that other teams are going to look at and be able to model on as we kind of get into the playoffs? Is there any worry looking at this game? Because the Patriots have been on a serious winning streak. As you said, the 49ers are a great team. It's not sort of unexpected the Patriots would lose to them. But is there anything sort of more dangerous than just a loss coming out of this as we look ahead?
There's a danger in overreacting to it, because the 49ers are a really good team. What teams could go to school on would be how the 49ers defense slowed the Patriots down in the first half. Now, I can't sit here and pretend I'm some sort of football expert. I'm listening to Chris Collinsworth on TV. But they were playing a certain way, man-to-man defense on the Patriot receivers. That worked because they had a strong enough pass rush too. So you need that type of personnel to be execute that, but it certainly is an idea that worked that other teams could borrow.
All right. So what's the silver lining coming out of the loss yesterday?
Well, what a comeback. And it just shows how terrific the Patriots offense is, how it really is one of the best offenses in the history of the NFL. I mean, it's almost equal to the 2007, which was a magical year.
All right. Well, so sounds like not all is lost. Not let's not overreact to a loss.
The bad part is that by losing, you know, they're probably going to have to play the opening round of the playoffs and not get a bye.
That's
the way it's looking. But we have 2 weeks to go, and they would then have to go on the road to probably Denver and Houston if a form held. Those are bad things.
Yeah, and it should be mentioned the Denver quarterback, somebody that we know well in this town, is Mr. Peyton Manning. So we could be seeing a Tom Brady Peyton Manning playoff battle once again.
Wouldn't that be fun?
It would be really cool. All right, so moving on from the Patriots, it's also the midst of basketball season here. The Celtics have lost 2 straight. They have a really busy week this week, 3 games leading up to a Christmas time game. Where are they at this point in the season? How are the Celtics playing?
Yeah, they're about 500, and they've been kind of disappointing. Doc Rivers, out of the blue after a loss on Friday, declared his team out of shape, not fit enough to finish games.
Physically out of shape.
Yes, and it's... It's the same thing he said last year. So I guess he has to work on that. And certainly they improved as the season went on last year. One thing to keep in mind with the Celtics is that Avery Bradley, one of their starting guards, hasn't played yet this year. He has he had shoulder surgery. I almost
That's
didn't
a tough
get that.
One. Try it 3 times fast. Shoulder surgery. I can barely say. It's hard.
But he's going to be coming back in January, they hope. That should help them. Certainly Courtney Lee is a player they acquired to try to replace Avery Bradley during the early part of the season. It hasn't worked out that well. He's been inconsistent. So they need Bradley back, and I think that's going to really help them.
Is this team much different than the team last year? I mean, I think one of the things to think about as they're around 500 right now, they were under 500 at this time, this many games into the season last year. Last year, of course, was different because you had a lockout and the season started late. But, you know, they still ended up 1 win away from the NBA Finals last year. So is this same team as last year? Is it a very different team than last year? Are the concerns different at this point?
Potentially it's a better team than last year. Hmm. Now, that would factor in that Paul Pierce and Kevin Garnett would play to the level they played at last year.
Yeah.
They are getting older. So the skills deteriorate. But I think they're deeper. And when they get Avery Bradley back and they can bring Jason Terry off the bench to give them some scoring, if Jeff Green, coming off heart surgery, for goodness sake, can start to play with some consistency. The reason I reference heart surgery is that I think needs some patience with him too. you know, he had an aortic root surgery, and he wow. missed last season. It takes a while to work your way back in. I think let's revisit this in a couple months and see where they are.
All right. Do they miss Ray Allen at this point?
Well, they do. They're not getting the offense at guard that he would have provided. Yeah. That's true.
So as long as we're on basketball, I want to get your take on something that I find really fascinating that's happening in college sports right now, and that's to do with the Big East. Of course, Boston College was once a Big East school. They left more than a decade ago, I guess, now to go to the ACC. And Providence, which is another local school here, and we have a lot of listeners down in Providence. Providence, of course, one of those Big East schools that's one of these basketball-only schools. The Big East sort of known as a college basketball conference. A few years back, they kind of got into the business of football. There's been a huge shakeup all over college athletics with these conferences over the last few years. But big news out of the Big East this week or last week, that seven schools, these sort of non-FBS schools, and I guess that means not schools that aren't in participating in the highest level of football, they're leaving. They're leaving the Big East. What's going on here?
Well, first off, let me as I give you my viewpoint of this, let me tell you where I'm coming from. I want everything to go back to 1965. And the way the conferences were then. So that's not going to happen. But
how were they in 65?
Well, I think things were more geographically oriented and smaller groups.
So the Big
groups.
East meant the East.
No, the Big East didn't even exist in 1965. Right. So I won't even go back before that. But what they're doing here, in the words of the president of Villanova said this yesterday, they want to control their own destiny. They feel their destiny has been taken over by the goals of football, which are not a big-time football, which doesn't apply to their schools. Villanova does play football on, like what I would call
one double A.
Yeah, one double A. They have a certain amount of scholarships, but they want to control their own destinies, and they felt they were being taken away and steered in a different direction by the sport of football, and they want basketball to be the most important sport for their schools. And most of these conference realignments are motivated by greed, that people are looking for bigger paydays, bigger bowl games in football. These schools are not – this really is not a money grab in this case. They might lose money because they get money from football because they're in the same league as football teams. But they want to control their own destiny.
How does it work? I mean, as best as you can kind of explain it, the idea – like, you know, if this is being motivated by greed or money, these realignments, you hear a lot of times you hear about there's television money or bowl game money or big-time football money. Where's the money coming from? How does it work?
Yeah, and it's more the TV money than the bowl game money. The bowl game money can be a little bit of a mirage because there's charges involved with the bowl game. UConn went to the Fiesta Bowl a few years ago and lost millions of dollars because of the expenses aren't covered.
Really?
Yes, and so that's kind of fake. But the TV money is real, and most of it comes from ESPN. Some of it comes from Fox and CBS. But this is where these schools will get money from ESPN for the rights to televise their games, and these are huge, millions and millions of dollars that's involved here.
And is it that, say, like if I'm ESPN, am I negotiating a contract with the conference, and then that money gets split among the schools?
That's correct. That's correct, and then they share it equally.
So this is why you have these schools kind of wanting to line up with football-heavy schools, because the money comes in that way.
Well, football is what generates the money. These contracts are for televising football. The amount of money you get for televising basketball is just pales in comparison.
Really? With March Madness?
Even with March Madness. Now, the March Madness package that CBS and Turner, that is, I think, $1 billion, but that's shared by with 300-some schools. So it doesn't equal if you're sharing football money among 10 to 12 schools.
Yeah.
It's a huge difference. And it's, I mean, it's all a money grab. Everyone wants to be involved in getting the TV money.
Do you think, I mean, you said earlier you wish it could go back to, you know, the 1960s and how the conferences
were there. Yeah, I'm
sorry
for saying
that. No, that's okay. That's totally okay. But what?
I'm such an old person.
No, it's all right. You know, hey, it's cool to be retro. Uh-huh. No, but I'm curious, in the absence of being able to go back to that, when you see something like this happen, for example, for Providence, is this a good thing? Is this a bad thing? Is this something different than what we've seen?
I think this is a good thing for Providence. They're going to group with schools that are like themselves. Now, the bad part is, of course, these seven schools now are going to turn around and take four or five schools from another league and mess with that league. So
right.
It's not all positive, in my opinion. But they'll be then grouped with schools that make the most sense, not with big state schools that emphasize football. Providence will be involved with smaller private schools that where basketball is most important. It makes sense to me. And that really is more 1965, like when you're talking about regional rivalries and traditional rivalries, which suffer because of these conference realignments. That's more of what the 1965 thing I'm talking about.
Yeah.
That the traditional rivalries just go by the boards because of these realignments.
Are schools being penny wise and pound foolish by sort of, kind of like you said, sort of selling out these traditions on some level for what seems to be sort of short term money right now? I mean, the Big East is something that has a huge tradition in basketball, at least a few decades old.
Right.
You know, playing in Madison Square Garden at the end of each year in their tournament. You know, these teams like Georgetown and Villanova and St. John's. You know, some of these other conferences, as like the Big Ten, which doesn't resemble the Big Ten at all from 5 years ago, are they hurting themselves in the long term?
Well, I think there could be a dilution of the brand. How's that for corporate thought?
Nicely done.
That could be applied here. I think that is a possibility, and certainly fan interest could dip with the reduction of traditional rivalries, in my opinion.
So I'm talking with Joe Sullivan. He's sports editor at the Boston Globe. We talked a little Patriots, talked a little bit about the Celtics and Big East basketball. We still have a couple major sports just touch base on them. Hockey still not being played, still a lockout. It seems like it is now going from the bargaining table to the courtroom. There's been some movement this weekend. The players are now in a five-day period, which started Sunday, ends Thursday, where they are voting on whether or not to give their executive board power to dissolve the union. The league has countered by filing some sort of suit in New York. What's happening? What's going to happen? What's your best guess?
Well, I think, you know, this is all part of the negotiation in the overview. But the league is trying to get the courts to say their lockout is legal. By dissolving, I think what the goal is for the union is then they can file an antitrust suit against the owners and then hope they get relief from the courts. It's still all about getting what they feel each side feels they deserve out of this contract impasse. So you would think that if they get into a situation one side or the other where they feel they're going to lose in court, then you might get a negotiated settlement. Mm. I think that's what the goal is.
So speaking of the idea,
but it could take a long time.
Yeah, speaking of the idea of hurting the brand, how much damage is the NHL doing to themselves? Or, you know, I should say the NHL and the players. When I say the NHL, I don't just mean the owners. I just mean writ large, all of them. They've already lost a season in the last handful of years to this. It was already sort of lagging as the fourth major sport, certainly in this country. I know it's bigger in Canada, but there's not as many dollars in Canada. How much damage do you think they're doing right now?
Well, I think in the traditional cities, what we saw the last time was that Bruins fans returned, the Canadian fans returned. It really is their game. People in Detroit came back, Minnesota, places that love hockey, where hockey is part of the culture. But I don't know what that speaks to fans in the warm weather cities that they've, you know, are people in Tampa, Miami, and Nashville, and Phoenix could lose interest quickly, I think. It could be a big mistake.
Is the league going to have to get smaller?
I think that's part of the conversation here, but I don't think the union would be in favor of that. That's
right.
Fewer jobs.
Yeah.
So baseball talked about that at one point. It never happened. I'd be surprised if that happened.
Okay. Does it filter down and hurt colleges? We have two of the biggest college hockey programs in the country here in BU and BC, and certainly strong ones at other schools as well. Does professional hockey being hurt these schools?
Well, there I am talking about the Globe again, and this is really my only basis of answering this question.
Yeah.
Is a Globe article which said that the NHL being on strike hurts attendance and interest in college hockey and in the minor league hockey, the American Hockey League, which has a team in Providence. And
part of you feels
Worcester.
Like it should help, right? Part of you feels like people can't go to an NHL game, well, why don't I go to an AHL game or I'll go see BU play? But that's not happening?
It's not happening.
Interesting. That's kind of fascinating. So I'm speaking with Joe Sullivan, sports editor for the Boston Globe. So we are in the hot stove right now, the off season for baseball. Where does that term come from, by the way? Do you know? I have no idea. This is a term that people use, you know, for the off season and all this, the machinations that happen in the baseball off season.
I could, you know, I'm going to think
it's wildly speculating right here. Live, you know, on Boston Public
it's
Radio.
Winter, it's cold, and you have people sitting around an old potbelly stove trying to keep warm, and they're talking about baseball.
Well,
that's where I think it comes.
We'll take it. So the Red Sox, like a couple of other teams, though, really seem to be kind of lining things up now for next year. They've had a couple of signings. The most recent one today, Stephen Drew, and if that last name sounds familiar, that is J.D. Drew's brother. He was signed pending a physical, I guess, to a one-year contract, $9.5 million. He's going to play shortstop. What's he all about?
We just have to hope he doesn't come with all the aches and pains of his older brother.
Yeah, no kidding.
Look, he's really just an average player, I'd say. You know, he hits about, I think, lifetime, like 265. He's a good defensive player, but you know what? He played in Arizona. Who saw him play? Only the biggest of baseball fans will have seen him play out in Arizona.
Yeah, that's totally true. So you know, we expect him to come in. Is he going to be the starting shortstop? They got that youngster Iglesias, who I guess will he play with the team? Will he go down to the minors?
I think he'd have to go to Pawtucket. They want him to play every day and work on his offense.
Okay, so
he is a great defensive player and. We still think he's the shortstop of the future for the Red Sox, just not 2013.
Just not quite yet. A couple other signings, that Mike Napoli signing. Apparently he failed a physical. What's happening there?
I don't know if he necessarily failed the physical, but there are some medical problems where they're trying to negotiate it within the contract. This same thing happened with J.D. Drew, speaking of him.
Yeah.
And it took 5 weeks to finally nail down the contract language. It had to do with J.D. Drew's shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
And so it might take a while just to nail down the contract language. It doesn't mean he's not coming here.
Okay, a couple of the two biggest players on the free agent market, you know, both of whom had at some point had speculated that potentially the Red Sox could be in the running for Zach Greinke, the pitcher. He went to the Dodgers. Josh Hamilton, outfielder, went to the Angels. Should the Red Sox have pursued either of them a little bit more aggressively?
Well, their philosophy has been not to do that. They're not going to spend those big dollars on those players. There is some situations with both those players. You know, Josh Hamilton with a history of drug addiction, alcoholism, and Zach Greinke with anxiety disorder. I think that it's a big those are one of the reasons the Red Sox didn't get involved with those players.
All right. But at this point, do you like how the Sox team's shaping up? Should they be better than next year?
I'm just going to withhold judgment. It seems like these aren't exciting signings, and I can't get on board yet.
Yep. All right. Well, that's Joe Sullivan, sports editor for the Boston Globe, taking us all the way through all four major sports and some college sports here today. So still good news for the Patriots, he says, even though they had a tough loss last night. So there you have it. Thanks, Joe, for being with us again.
Thank you.
And in response to the mass shooting over the weekend, Emily Rooney is going to be checking in with City Hall in just a minute to see how the Mayors Against Illegal Guns Coalition is responding to a tragedy that involved only legal weapons. This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Edgar B. Herwick III.